Welcome back, hour two of the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Dominic, we welcome back a fine guest. He is James Santel, former U.S. attorney, a friend of ours, and a fine legal resource. Jim, welcome back to the big show.
Mike, Don, good to be with you once again in the wake of one of Donald Trump's worst days before the United States Supreme Court.
Well, thank you, Jim.
Before we talk about the U.S. Supreme Court, let's deal with the impeachment. The impeachment unfulfilling for so many different reasons, Jim. Obviously, the vote was 57-43, so not a satisfactory conclusion of the impeachment trial. But I thought perhaps these congressional hearings, Jim, would give us another opportunity, we the American people, to get to the truth, to the bottom of this. But we also gave a platform for the jackassery of Ron Johnson. I want to get your impression of the hearings going off today, Jim.
Right. You know, a number of different things obviously going on in Capitol Hill. One of them, as you indicated, very, very important in terms of getting the American public to appreciate the nature and the scope of what happened on January 6th. Lots of good information coming out of that, plainly some of it politically motivated, frankly, when it comes to some of the questions. But plainly, this is one of the areas where the United States Congress does have oversight functions, as we've discussed in the past, and should be asking these important questions of the people who are there. We get a little bit more information about what was happening, and mostly we get information about the information provided to the Capitol Police. What did they know? What kinds of intelligence do they have? And how do they prepare for it? All of these things, I think, in anticipation of the creation of a larger commission that Nancy Pelosi has advocated for to address this from start to bottom, the same way they looked at 9/11, looked at the assassination of John Kennedy many, many years ago, to really tell the American public how this happened and to ensure, most importantly, that it doesn't happen again.
Jim, have we answered the question, did the legislative leadership, be it Nancy Pelosi or Mitch McConnell, they really didn't have any control over protecting the Capitol that day? At least that was my understanding.
Right. I think that was pretty much the takeaway, both implicitly and explicitly. And as I look at that and think about my own presence in federal buildings, we rely dramatically upon Federal Protective Service, upon Capitol Police, if you happen to be in the Capitol, the local police to ensure safety and security. They're the experts. And candidly, with all due respect to leadership in the House and the Senate, we don't want those people necessarily to be the ones who are dictating or making decisions about policy when it comes to law enforcement practices, how best to manage those kinds of very, very difficult issues. Those are sophisticated matters, and they should be in the hands of people who are trained, who've got the background, and plainly in consultation with the leadership so that the law enforcement activity does not intrude upon or inhibit that process, which is at number one on the list, but still deferring a whole lot to law enforcement when it comes to management and understanding how they can the government can go on safely and securely.
Folks, you're listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Our pal James Santel, former U.S. attorney, joining us. Jim, I was thinking about you all day yesterday, man, when the news broke about the U.S. Supreme Court coming down against Donald Trump. This has been going on for quite some time, Jim. I guess I'm not surprised. Certainly want to get your impression, sir.
No, I think that's exactly right. I'm not surprised, Professor, at all, that you would come to that conclusion, because it is indeed what I think most people anticipated. The history in this, of course, has been long, as you also indicated. This is Cyrus Vance, the DA out of Manhattan, who has been conducting at least a couple of years of investigation, very broad as far as we can tell, on everything from insurance to taxes to property valuations to bank loans to commerce, all kinds of things. Issues this subpoena to basically the accountant and the accounting firm of not only the president's tax returns, but plainly all the information that goes into that, goes up to the Supreme Court. A first time, Supreme Court rejects the president's position at that time that he's immune from this because he's the president, goes back down, and the Supreme Court says that the president at that time can raise anything that it's available to any other regular person who's subject to a subpoena, and including whether or not the subpoena is overly broad. The now former president contests that again, goes back a second time, and now we get the decision yesterday that says, no, not overbroad, comply with the subpoena, walk down the street, present this to Mazars, get the information you want, which is probably terabytes of information, and that means the DA now has it, and should be able to proceed with further with his very expansive and broad and probably not too much delayed, but certainly road bumped away investigation up to this point.
Well, it seems, Jim, I mean, this has been a long time coming, and perhaps the wheels of justice turn slowly and yada, yada, and he was the president and all these kinds of things. But it seems to be taking a very long time, in my opinion. Millions of pages, terabytes, as you mentioned, since this has been going on and Cy Vance has been, you know, doing his work, do you feel like, is it your impression perhaps that the foundation and some of the framework of their arguments are already set? And all they need is do is to fill in some of these missing puzzle pieces or, you know, confirm certain things. How quickly do you think they can, you know, sift through this data to get those missing pieces? How fast do you think they would come to some conclusion, Jim?
It is a huge amount of information. Again, understanding people think this is the tax returns case, and it is in part. But I think the more interesting piece, those tens of thousands of documents, if you've got an accountant, he or she, the company, has lots of information that you provided to it about valuations, about plainly about Donald Trump's properties in Manhattan, other places, communications back and forth, recommendations about how to file those returns, all kinds of things. That's the real treasure trove here that Cy Vance has. And so it will take some time. But again, this investigation has been going on for a long time. We know that Deutsche Bank, we found out last year, has already complied with the subpoena. Sort of, we were surprised to learn that along the way. Plainly, Cy Vance has been talking to witnesses. We know that Michael Cohen plainly has a lot of information to provide about how the Trump Organization and Donald Trump in particular works. So this is very far down the road, if you will. Not ready to say that this is going to be, there's going to be a charge next week. It's difficult to imagine, however, that we'll go through the entire 2021 without something being charged here of great significance.
Jim, I'm sorry to interrupt, Dom, but I need a little reminder of someone, because I can't go to Dominic for memory work. But Weisselman, the former, chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, now he's been granted some sort of immunity to give testimony, my understanding. Is it in this case, Jim, is that the Vance case that the immunity to the CFO of the Trump Org has been extended?
Right. And so again, he's got it exactly right. He is, again, another one of these linchpin people, plainly, that when Michael Cohen testifies in front of Congress, he's even spoken about this plainly in the media, he identifies Weisselberg as a key figure. And so, yes, there's no doubt that he's got that immunity in his pocket. We don't know exactly what he is saying, but plainly, one of the predicates for getting immunity is honesty, which can be corroborated or not corroborated by other documents coming in. And so a very helpful source along the way, probably not the target of the investigation ultimately. We assume that it is most likely Donald Trump himself, could be family members, could be others in the Trump Corporation. But no doubt Weisselberg is one of those people like Michael Cohen, who knows a lot, who can also interpret many of the documents, maybe even coming out of Mazars today, plenty from Deutsche Bank, other sources, to interpret all this. We know, of course, that the DA has also hired a private firm as well to try to take, it's called FTI, it's a consulting firm, to try to make sense of things that are far beyond me to understand when it comes to commercial exercises and enterprises in Manhattan. We've got that going on. Mark Pomerantz has recently been brought on by the DA, kind of this longtime expert in these areas. Lots of things indicating this is not going away. This is, if anything, ramping up and probably heading toward, as I said, some serious charges against someone sometime fairly soon.
Jim, of the exposure that we understand that the former president might be exposed to, the tax issue, if he's devaluing properties in order to, you know, get a reduced tax bill. Let's look at just something, an example like that, because I want to get a sense of what kind of punishment and what did he get away with. So if he had, for instance, a huge property, he's got expensive properties, and he played this game and got a reduced tax burden of $50,000 a year. And they're looking at 8 years, call it, you know, $400,000 in reduced taxes based on this, you know, kind of fraud that he's perpetuating. If that situation were to be the case, can you go back further than the 8 years that they're looking at if you see this kind of thing? And assuming that's only one property or one instance, does all that money, accumulated benefit from the fraud, does that kind of add up and add up? If it gets higher and higher, does it become more of a legal issue for the former president?
Sure, lots of very good things to unpack there. One is that, yes, there's a statute of limitations. We know that about any criminal charge, whether it's in the state system or the federal system. Usually it's 5 years, sometimes it's 10 years for banking allegations in the federal system in particular. The nature of the offense conduct can be particular to specific counts. For example, if I do it in a 1 year, I could do it 1 year and I could do it the next year. Each one of those could be a separate count under bank fraud or insurance fraud or other kinds of commercial fraud. Each one of those could carry with it 5 years, 10 years, depending upon the particular way that it's charged. And yes, you can also go back even beyond a statute of limitations if you're alleging a conspiracy. If you're alleging a 20-year conspiracy, the substantive counts might be inside that conspiracy. But the conspiracy itself can include lots and lots of things outside the statute, including lots of monies, as you indicated, Dom, lots of activities that may not be the focus of a specific substantive count. So, again, given the breadth of this and the scope of what Cy Vance is on top of, my anticipation would be you're going to get lots of counts here. Lots of different areas. Maybe some are going to be surprised at. Maybe in some areas there's no there, as we often say. But in others, given the fact that we are looking at this for a long period of time, likely multiple substantive counts could be an overreaching count as well.
Jim Santelli, you got a few more minutes, man, because I want to know what happens. Let's presume a conviction eventually. Then what happens? Appeal. Does the man ever go to prison? Will they remand the white-collar financial criminal? I've got many questions. Hopefully you got our answers. James Santel, our good friend and fine guest, former U.S. attorney. Stick around. More Devil's Advocates. We'll be right back.
I pay hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes.
You believe that story? You believe that?
Nobody knows more about taxes than I do.
The Devil's Advocates. Political commentary from the back of the class.
And we are back. Thank you for listening to the Devil's Advocates radio show. If you miss any of this fine program, please go online to domandcroot.com. You can listen to and download podcasts and interviews.
Dominic, we got a fine guest. He's generously stuck around. He is former U.S. Attorney James Santel. I appreciate you sticking, Jim, because I got more questions. Let's assume.
Bring up more questions, and we'll try to get answers.
Multi-count indictments rain down upon Donald Trump, and he goes to court. He has his, his process, and he's convicted. And then what, Jim? Because I see these as primarily white-collar federal crimes, and they might not be as, as sexy or salacious as, let's say, paying off a porn star. But tax crimes have real teeth, my understanding, under prosecution. But will he be thrown in jail immediately? Do you see a likelihood? I mean, he's not going to get hauled off to Rikers Island, right? They'll give him every opportunity, every benefit of appeal. Would you not think, sir?
You know, the basic approach on these things in the state courts, the federal courts, if the former president should be charged, and again, we're assuming he would be convicted of some criminal conduct there, is whether or not you are a risk of flight and you're a danger to the community. Danger to the community is probably, I know that you might disagree with me on this, he's probably not a traditional danger to the community outside of the White House as he now is. Risk of flight, another issue. And so that's the kind of thing that a judge would have to decide if, in fact, there's a conviction. Even after charging initially, there's got to be an arraignment and a decision about what to do in terms of custody. But you're right. In normal circumstances, we would not anticipate that a white-collar defendant of this sort would be detained and perhaps even at sentencing would not get the kind of very dramatic sentences that usually attend to violent crimes. On the other hand, understanding that the president, the former president, has lots of exposure, not just in Manhattan, but he's also facing, obviously, there's a DA in Fulton County, Georgia, who's looking at the events of the weekend before January 6th and whether or not he attempted to undermine the election there. We've got those issues. It is possible that our incoming attorney general could also revisit lots of issues federally out of the U.S. Department of Justice. And plainly, the attorney general in D.C. is also looking at the president. So he's got a lot of different exposure in a lot of different areas. Those are just the criminal matters, of course. And so it may well be that he's not only exposed to large penalties, but in multiple jurisdictions, so that we may even get this concern about which one goes first if there are multiple charges. In the end, a sentencing judge has a lot to think about. We've never had a former president who has been convicted of crimes, certainly felonies. What do you do with that person? Well, I would certainly advocate that if the charges are proven, and if, again, based upon everything we know about the defendant in this case, prison time would not be inappropriate. And again, plainly, you'd have to make special arrangements for that to be served. But it's a weighty thing. We've never had to face this before. 2021, probably, you're right, 2022, 2023, 2024 would be more likely the time that all these cases might well be disposed of.
Jim, you mentioned you don't envision he's a dangerous defendant, but do you worry in the same way he incited violence against the U.S. Capitol and the process when they were trying to certify the Electoral College against him? Could you envision defendant Trump calling it a witch hunt, calling it a fake trial, saying he's being politically prosecuted? Go storm the federal courthouse. Go charge the DA. I mean, there's lots of ways he could create mischief in the legal process.
Sure. And so again, when I say that normally white collar defendants are not a danger to the community, we don't think about them again robbing banks again and distributing drugs and doing those kinds of violent crime things, especially if they're well known in the white collar area. It's unlikely if someone's charged with insurance fraud or real estate fraud, and it's publicly known that you're going to be able readily to victimize more people. And so in that sense, perhaps not a danger to the community, but given this particular person's past history, that capacity to bring forward lots and lots of people, frankly, at the drop of a tweet and plainly at in a public forum, absolutely. And so you could also get a judge who's presiding over a case to say, you know what, I don't want you talking about this. I don't want you out there in the media. I remember the Roger Stone case that the federal district judge said just that. He violated that a number of occasions, got into some trouble. But judges do have supervisory authority, as do the supervising agents themselves, to say, you know what, while this is pending, I don't want you to appear in the media. I don't want you to be out there on Fox News or CNN or whatever venue you may select. And if you violate that, then you are in violation of the terms of your release, and then you can go to jail pretrial. So lots of different opportunities here. And you're right, this is not the typical, certainly would not be the typical white-collar type defendant for many, many reasons. We've identified at least two of them right now.
Jim Santel, former U.S. attorney, just got 2 minutes here. I'm going to jump in here quickly, Crudy. Certainly the white-collar crimes, but he's also was active in a campaign. Individual number one, I believe, was from the Stormy Daniels, right? That really had been put to bed, and we saw the fixer go to jail for that. And then some of these reports, when his campaign was running low, he engineered, multi-million dollar payments out of some Vegas casino, some casino somewhere. I mean, the things to do with the campaign, I would say, are separate from some of this real estate crime, insurance crime. Do you see some exposure there, especially if there were foreign funds distributed somehow?
There are lots and lots of possibilities here that U.S. Department of Justice could be looking at. Elections violations, obviously overseas matters, all of those things. They probably are also inside some of these materials that Cy Vance is getting too. Obviously, if it's a complete package about his financial information and transactions in recent years, including the valuation of properties here in the United States and overseas, a lot of that's going to be packed in there as well. Plainly, lots of possibilities here for charges in those areas, including campaign violations as well.
Well, Jim, I'd have taken that question a whole different direction. I asked you about Trump exhausting all of his remedies through the Supreme Court, obviously, to overturn the election in any way, shape, or form. Since that's a dead-end street, we'll just assume you agree it's a dead-end street. Not if you agree.
I think it is now, especially after yesterday. The other thing the Supreme Court did, of course, was shut down the cases, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin significantly, the three others as well. All of those cases now are pretty much at an end, decisively, from the United States Supreme Court saying, no more, we're not doing this anymore. And again, we had three dissenting justices, but they said, you know what,
Jim, if we're doing that, this interview must end. Thank you so much, sir. Michael Thanks, Crawford Jim. From MoveOn.org is next.
You're under arrest, Trump.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?